Beginning on slide 33, I'd like to give you a pretty brief overview of what we mean when we talk about chemical contaminants. First, it's necessary to recognize that there are many potential chemical contaminants that are widely available and which vary greatly in their health effects, such as the acute toxicity that Stan just talked about. Second, detecting some of these contaminants in water presents some special challenges. Detections of others is rather routine. Drinking water distribution systems may spread the contaminant over vast distances, although changes to the contaminated water may occur within the distribution system. Finally, various physical and chemical properties of the contaminants may affect their ability to efficiently contaminate and persist in water systems. In the next few minutes, I'd like to tell you a little bit about each of these bulleted items in a little more detail. On page 34, we begin by looking at the common groupings of chemical contaminants. Inorganic chemicals are represented by cyanide. Organic chemicals have, as an example, various pesticides. Schedule 1 chemical weapons, such as mustard and nerve agents, are another category. Biotoxins are a fourth, and radiochemicals are a fifth. On page 35, I'd like to give you a little bit of an overview over what we mean when we talk about chemical weapons. Chemical weapons are very precisely and legally defined by law, and these specific toxic chemicals are covered in listings which are known as schedules. Schedule 1 contains chemicals that have been developed, produced, stockpiled, or used as chemical weapons or chemicals that are precursors of these weapons. Schedule 1 chemicals have no large-scale industrial purpose. By contrast, Schedule 2 contains chemicals that pose a significant risk to the objectives of the Chemical Weapons Convention or are precursors to the chemical weapons themselves, and they also have no legitimate industrial use. Schedule 3 chemicals do have some legitimate non-chemical warfare uses, and these are chemicals that have been developed, produced, stockpiled, or used as chemical weapons, but again, they do have some legitimate purposes. So this, I give you this definition to contrast on page 36 with the popular groupings of the chemical weapons, the nerve, the blister, the choking, the blood, and the vomiting agent. Those categories are largely historical. For example, the blood agent, hydrogen cyanide, doesn't actually work on the blood at all. So when talking about chemical weapons, it's important to keep in mind that there are just a few that are properly and legally defined in the Chemical Weapons Convention. However, it's useful for our purposes to make some generalities about these type of chemical contaminants. First, many are not all that stable in water because they were intended to be used in air. Many are difficult to obtain, and many, in fact, are gases, which goes along with their use in air. So on page 37, the other few points to keep in mind about chemical weapons is that, in fact, several of the Schedule 3 chemicals have been found in water as a result of disinfection. So, for example, if you find chlorpicrin in the water, that very well could be the result of the addition of chlorine to the water to disinfect the water. It doesn't mean that someone has intentionally added chlorpicrin to the water. The next point to keep in mind about chemical weapons is that water may not really be the best delivery mechanism for chemical weapons. And finally, as far as we're concerned, properties of chemical weapons are evaluated very similarly to other chemicals that we'll run into. On page 38 are a few words about biotoxins. A special category of chemicals, which you'll hear discussed. A biotoxin, very simply, is a toxin naturally produced by a microorganism, a plant, or an animal. These also may be synthesized in the laboratory. my other routes, but they were originally produced by the living organism. Some examples of these are ricin, which is a toxin derived from castor beans, and which is you hear about in the news more frequently. Then the next example, which is microcystins, which are toxins which are produced by blue-green algae, which are found, in fact, in many water systems. Now, biotoxins, some of them have a very low lethal dose relative to most other types of chemical contaminants. However, some of them are actually less toxic than some of the man-made organic chemicals that are commonly available. Although biotoxins may be used in an aerosol attack, they may also represent a source of concern for food and water contamination, which is why we're calling them out in particular here. Biotoxins have properties that can be evaluated just like any other chemical because they are just another type of organic chemical. On the next slide, we get into some of these properties of chemicals that may help us in looking at their effects on water systems. The first one is referred to as a chemical identity. Chemicals can be uniquely identified by their chemical abstract registry number, often called their CAS number. In finding properties of chemicals, the CAS is often very helpful because many chemicals go by a lot of other names. CAS numbers can be found in chemical catalogs, databases, and material safety data sheets. For example, the CAS number for glyphosate is 1071-86-83-6. That's a lot more simple identifier than many of the probably 10 or 20 synonyms that you'll see for glyphosate out there, and will help you a lot in looking up properties. The next slide on page 40 goes into the chemical detection of the contaminants we're looking at. Broadly speaking, the ability to detect a chemical contaminant in water is often a very important step in the investigation of contamination itself. As used here, detection falls into two main categories: sensory perception and actual chemical analysis. Sensory perception, as discussed on page 41, usually occurs when the drinking water customer complains that the water looks, smells, and/or tastes funny, but may or may not prevent the customer from drinking the water. Some contaminants may have distinctive odors and tastes, although perception of these by customers can vary dramatically. For some contaminants, some percentage of the population, they just can't taste it if it's in the water. It is not really always a sign of intentional contamination that customers complain about something smelling or tasting funny, because some water systems are naturally prone to complaints, particularly during particular times of the year. And your local water utility is probably quite familiar with what parts of town call in to complain about the water, say, in the spring. Now, a very important point about the sensory perception is that even if there's a report that the water smells like it has cyanide in it, or even something less harmful, never intentionally smell or taste a suspected sample. Some of the advice you see out there almost leads you to believe that, because they'll tell you that, cyanide smells like almonds, which brings us to the example at the bottom of the page 41, in which a customer is actually complaining of an almond smell to the water. However, on closer inspection of the customer's house, we find that they have a new almond scented shampoo. So it's most likely not the hydrogen cyanide that's responsible for that. On page 42, we find, as far as chemical detection is concerned, that compliance monitoring for regulated chemical contaminants will most likely not detect the presence of many of the potential chemical contaminants of concern. Compliance monitoring by the water utilities for some chemicals is sometimes only required a few times a year, and for some contaminants it's required even less frequently than that. Water quality laboratories are often capable of analyzing water for many regulated chemicals of concern. However, special techniques are required for confirming the presence of some Schedule I chemical warfare agents, as well as some biotoxins. Early warning or rapid field detection is not available for many contaminants of concern. Also, changes in baseline water quality parameters, such as pH, turbidity, residual chlorine, may or may not indicate the presence of a contaminant. So, with those brief words of advice on chemical detection, let's move on to slide 43, which talks about the fate and transport of a chemical within a drinking water system. The fate and transport of a chemical as it moves through a water system to the tap depends on the nature of the contaminant as well as the nature of the water system. Now, predicting the fate and transport is often really quite complicated and relies on two main things. First of all, an accuracy of the physical and chemical property data in the literature for the particular contaminant, and also a knowledge of the individual drinking water system. Now, because these two factors are important, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about them. On page 44, you see a schematic of a basic drinking water system. On the left-hand side of the screen, the water starts out from the river or reservoir or the groundwater or some other source. It goes to the treatment plant, and eventually it winds up in this schematic in these buildings and houses. And eventually it all winds back up in the river through the sewage treatment process. But what we're mainly concerned about is illustrated on the next slide, slide 45, which shows a portion of the drinking water distribution system of an actual city. Each one of those little lines you see on the screen is actually a portion of the water distribution system. So there are really thousands of portions in this system, and some of these are houses, some of these are fire hydrants, and all of these are some place that someone could draw water from the system. So as you can imagine, with the sheer number of components, understanding the behavior of water and the contaminants and any contaminants within the distribution system is indeed a complex task. So without word of admonition, let's look at some of the contaminant properties. The next few slides will discuss several contaminant properties that are important to the fate and transport of the contaminant within the distribution system. One of these properties is solubility. The next is detectability. Next is treatability, and finally is stability. And we'll explain a little bit more about these as we go along. Along with the description of the property, we'll also look at how does the property help assess the threat. That is, how does knowing something about the property help us out in what we're trying to do. We'll also look at what limitations of the property may be important, and also try to provide just a really brief illustration of the property's relevance to the water system. Later on in the webcast, in a different section, you'll see how all these come together. But this hopefully will give you a good preview of that. So the first contaminant property is solubility. What is solubility? Well, it's the ability of a certain amount of chemical to dissolve in a certain amount of given solvent. In this case, we're mostly interested in water as a solvent. So, for example, 1 gram of sodium chloride dissolves in 2.8 milliliters of water at room temperature. How does solubility information help us assess the threat and hopefully deal with it? First, solubility must be compared to the concentration of concern in water. That is, a highly toxic, less soluble chemical may be soluble enough still to pose a public health threat. So this means that low solubility does not automatically imply a low threat. In the previous presentation, you may recall that there was an example calculation about how to do this. Some chemicals, which are soluble in water, may need to be dispersed, for example, by stirring in order to dissolve them. This is to say that although it doesn't dissolve readily in water, it can be possible to get it to dissolve in water. This is also true to some chemicals which are generally thought of as insoluble, but they can still be effectively dispersed in water, provided the greater technical challenge is overcome. So, for example, insoluble metals may need to be dissolved in acid and then added to the water. Pretty straightforward. Some insoluble chemicals are much more challenging than that. What sort of limitations on solubility information should you be aware of? Well, on page 48, we see that there are really a number of these. First of all is the solubility data itself. Solubility data is usually based on pure chemicals and not any other thing that's added to get them to dissolve better. And it's usually described in some of the popular literature in terms of words like very soluble, sparingly soluble, slightly. And these aren't very helpful, especially for highly toxic chemicals. You really need to find the solubility data that's expressed in a number, and you may have to go to particular sources to find that. A second limitation is that there are a number of factors which influence the solubility within the distribution system. For example, the temperature of the distribution system can affect the amount that will dissolve in the water, as will the pH and the total dissolved solids that are found in the distribution system water. For contaminants added at high concentrations that exceed solubility, it's important to remember that a layer of contaminant may be found on top or at the bottom of the water depending on the contaminant's density, which is the mass per unit volume. You will recall that water has a density of approximately 1 mass per unit volume, milligrams per liter, for instance, whereas oil has a density lower than water. It, for instance, somewhere around 0.8 milligrams per milliliter. Therefore, oil would float in the water. However, something more dense than water would sink to the bottom. This means that the absence of a contaminant film on the top or bottom of the water does not necessarily mean that no contamination is present. It could, on the other hand, mean that the contaminant is present below the solubility limit. So there's a couple of interplaying factors that need to be kept in mind. So as an illustration, someone adds 10 kilograms of a contaminant to a million-liter water tank. Now you look it up and find out that the lethal concentration, 50 of the liquid, is 2,000 milligrams per liter. Now the solubility data indicates the solubility is actually 0.1 milligrams per liter. So what does this indicate about where the contaminant will be? Well, I'll let you think about that one, and if you review the information in the previous slides, I think that one's pretty obvious. As a second illustration, one source for solubility data says that a particular contaminant is practically insoluble. Now, we consider that the LC50 for this contaminant is 30 milligrams per liter. So in this case, how does the toxicity compare with the solubility? Well, clearly there's not enough information to make that determination because the solubility was described as practically insoluble. You'll find that in many MSDS material data safety sheets tend to use that designation because of the purposes for which the MSDS was designed. You really have to look at a more sophisticated database of information to typically find an actual number for the solubility of the contaminant, and it's out there typically if you look. So the next contaminant property that we're interested in is what we're calling treatability. If you look up treatability in the dictionary, you might not find it there. But in this case, when we say treatability, we refer to the ability of water treatment technologies such as chlorination, sand filtration, activated carbon, ozonation, etc., to remove a contaminant or reduce its concentration in the water. How does treatability information help us to assess a threat? Well, on page 50, we see that it does so because the existing plant may be treating the water in such a way that the contamination is removed or mitigated rapidly, resulting in fewer long-term consequences. Also, treatability information may be relevant to remediation in the case that some contamination does actually make it into the water. On page 51, we continue with treatability information, and we see that there are a number of limitations on treatability information that you should be aware of. First of all, the efficacy of a particular process for a particular contaminant depends on the treatment technologies that are actually used at the plant. This is to say, if the contaminant is removed by ozonation and not chlorination, the treatment plant should have ozonation in line to be able to say that the treatment plant took care of it. And the water utility will be very familiar with what their plant is actually doing. A second limitation is that treatment data may not actually be available for many contaminants, and there are probably more contaminants that is not available than there are available, although some generalizations between classes of contaminants can be made. Another limitation is that the literature that you go to look for treatment data actually has some inconsistent data for some contaminants, possibly be resulting from the difference in treatment conditions from where one report was made to where another report was made. Treatability information applies generally to contamination added to the system before the treatment plant. It's very important to remember that after the water leaves the treatment plant, that the plants will add what's known as a residual disinfectant to the water. This is designed to control microbial regrowth in the distribution system, and pretty much it's the treatment barrier, the only treatment barrier that's available in the distribution system. So, as an illustration, suppose someone adds a quantity of a particular pesticide to the source water of the treatment plant. Well, you contact the utility, and as it turns out, they're using activated carbon, and it also, in this case, it's fortunate that the pesticide is really effectively removed by activated carbon. So this, all in all, mitigates the total amount of exposure exposure to the customers by the pesticide. On page 52. We introduced a contaminant property which we're calling stability. As used here, the stability is the ability of a contaminant to withstand degradation within the distribution system, which can reduce the toxicity or infectivity of a contaminant. Within the distribution system, stability is primarily a function of processes such as hydrolysis, volatilization, reactivity, and absorption. We'll talk about each of those separately in a few minutes. Biodegradation isn't really considered in this talk because biodegradation, which is the degradation of contaminant by a microorganism, may be more important than source water than is in the distribution system. How does stability information help us assess the threat? Well, the first thing to remember is that when available, degradation rate data may be used to estimate the half-life of a contaminant in a water system. Half-life is the time it takes for half of the contaminant to degrade. Thus, a chemical with a short half-life in a drinking water system may not persist long enough to have significant health effects on the public. However, a chemical with a longer half-life than drinking water system may persist for a sufficient time to have sufficient and significant effects on the public. On page 53, we see that there are a number of important limitations on this type of data you should be aware of. First, stability data, again, are based on pure chemicals, and depending on the stability process, the data may not be available for the chemical dissolved in water. For instance, reactivity are sometimes given for undissolved compounds, which can markedly differ than compounds' behavior in water. Again, MSDS, material safety data sheets, often are designed for another purpose other than water contamination, so some of that reactivity data you see on those will not really tell you what's going to happen in water. A second limitation is that estimates of half-life are not available for some contaminants. A third limitation is that environmental fate and transfer predictions rely on the accuracy of the physical and chemical property data in the literature. So you pretty much only get out of your prediction the quality that goes in. Now the final item I've put in orange on this slide, because it's very, very important to remember that due to the complexity of drinking water distribution systems, the amount of time that contaminated water can remain in the distribution system varies tremendously by location, even within the same distribution system. It can be an extremely complex task to apply degradation rates when trying to estimate how much contaminant the public has been exposed to. Moving on to page 54, we introduce this stability-related process that is called hydrolysis. What is hydrolysis? Well, hydrolysis is a reaction that occurs between the chemical and the water itself, often resulting in permanent degradation of the original chemical. How does this information help us as a threat? Well, hydrolysis may produce byproducts that are less toxic than the parent compound, and this is indeed the case for many chemicals. However, sometimes it is theoretically possible for the byproduct to be more toxic than the parent compound. Contaminants, especially highly toxic ones that are resistant to hydrolysis, may be of greater importance due to their persistence in water. What sort of limitations in this information should you be aware of? Well, like many of these other properties we're talking about, it's dependent on conditions within the distribution system itself, such as pH and temperature. And again, hydrolysis rate data are not available for all contaminants or are not available at the pHs or temperatures or other distribution system conditions that we're really interested in. So as an illustration on page 55, we have the half-life of a certain pesticide is listed as 2 days. Now, this may, on the surface, may seem good, but it also means that after 2 days, the concentration will only be half of the original, but will be quite present. And indeed, half of a very high concentration of a lethal chemical can still be quite a bit of a problem. Now, on the other hand, if you have the half-life of a particular chemical weapon being around 8 minutes at room temperature in water, then you can be fairly confident that within an hour or two, the concentration is essentially reduced to zero. Although, of course, starting with a very high concentration, you will still be left with some concentration even after an hour or two. On page 56, we look at the stability-related process called volatilization. What is volatilization? Well, volatilization is a process through which a contaminant dissolved in the water enters the gas phase, that is, the air above the water. Henry's law constants are essentially determined from the equilibrium ratio of the concentration in the air to the concentration of the water, and these constants do help provide some information about volatilization. Now, another important piece of information to decide if your contaminant will volatilize sufficiently is the vapor density of the contaminant, which is its density of the gaseous vapor relative to the density of the air. Now, how does this information help assess a threat? Well, Henry's law constants provide an indication of whether the chemical is likely to move from the aqueous phase to the gas phase, that is, from the contaminated water to the air. And you may have recalled in the toxicological overview that some contaminants are, in fact, quite a bit more toxic by inhalation than they are by ingestion. So this can be quite a threat if you have the right contaminant. Now, the vapor density provides an indication of how quickly the contaminant could dissipate. And all in all, these types of information may help predict the risk due to inhalation. On 57, we see there are a number of limitations to this type of information that you should be aware of. First, Henry's law constant assumes equilibrium conditions. However, volatilization is not an equilibrium process, even in theory, and in practice within a distribution system would be far from equilibrium. Henry's law constants and other volatilization information is usually only determined for very small concentrations, not necessarily the large concentrations you'd find in water. Like many of these properties, volatilization data are temperature dependent, and in water under specific conditions, it's important to remember that contaminants may coexist in both volatile and non-volatile forms, which interprets affects the amount of volatile contaminant, also our interpretation of the data. As an illustration, we see that the dimensionless Henry's law constant for benzene is 0.25, which means that the concentration in water will be four times the amount in air. As a second illustration, which more or less points to the limitation, is that at drinking water pHs, sodium cyanide is present as hydrogen cyanide, which then can volatilize from the water. At higher pHs, it's present as cyanide ion, which is not volatile from the water. Another stability-related process is reactivity, which is talked about on page 58. What is reactivity? Well, reactivity is a reaction between a contaminant and another substance. We previously discussed hydrolysis, which is a special case of reactivity, in which case the other substance is water. However, in water systems, there are many potential types of reactive substances. And a principal reaction of interest occurs between an oxidant and the contaminant of concern. You may recall that most drinking water plants will add a residual oxidant to the water after it leaves the plant. So frequently you find a very reactive compound called chlorine in the water. How does this reactivity information help assess a threat? Well, the oxidation of a chemical contaminant frequently, but not always, decreases the toxicity of the water. Another way this helps us assess this threat is that reaction rates for different contaminants can vary very dramatically from instantaneous to nearly imperceptible. So naturally, the ones that are instantaneous are going to have a whole different assessment than ones which react very, very slowly. How does reactivity have any, does reactivity have any limitations that you should be aware of? Well, yes, it does, like many of these other properties. First, oxidation is dependent on the temperature and pH. We've heard that before. And also the presence and concentration of other substances in the water may significantly affect the oxidation rate. For instance, if there's something else in the water that's reacting with the chlorine, then it's not going to be available to react with a contaminant. And this is really a common situation, or can be a common situation, that there are other substances in the water that will react with chlorine. On page 59 is an illustration of reactivity. Well, there are several illustrations. The first illustration is that a certain pesticide is known to react rapidly with chlorine. So you measure the chlorine residual at the tap and find there is a large one. So therefore, you would feel that it may be less likely that the pesticide is present at the tap, or at least a particular tap that you're measuring at. Second of all, contamination with a chlorine-sensitive contaminant is suspected, so you measure the chlorine residual at the tap. You find very little. Does this indicate contamination? Maybe, maybe not. Some portions of the distribution system have far less residual than what was added to the plant due to that natural chlorine decay due to largely due to reaction of other substances normally present in the distribution system anyway. So you can't really form a conclusion on that. A final illustration is that in arsenic treatment of water systems, sometimes oxidation is used to change the form of arsenic and is known to frequently reduce the toxicity in ezer removal. Another stability-related process is absorption. What is absorption? On page 60, we see that it is a measure of the tendency of a chemical to partition out of the water into a substance with an organic-like phase, which includes certain sediments, some water system components, pipes, etc. The octanol water partition coefficient may be an indicator. This is abbreviated by KOW, and it is the concentration of the contaminant in octanol divided by the concentration of water after the contaminant equilibrates between the two solvents. How does this information help us assess a threat? Well, the absorptive characteristics may be related to the fate of a chemical in the water system. It also may provide an indication of the chemical's persistence in the water system, which is to say, it may provide an indication of the need to remediate the system. A compound with a higher KOW may be more likely to persistently contaminate drinking water system components than a contaminant with a lower one. A slow release of contaminants from the water system components could taint the water until enough water has, in fact, passed through the water system components of pipes and whatnot for sufficient desorption of the contaminant to occur. So that situation, you're looking at a long-term contamination issue. On page 61, we see that there are a number of limitations in absorption information that you should be aware of. First and foremost is that the reliability of KOW as a predictor to indicate partitioning of the chemical is highly dependent on the chemical as well as the material through which the chemical is partitioning. Naturally, not all materials have an organic-like phase that behaves like octanol. Another limitation is that the dependency between the chemical and the particular type of piping material is largely unknown, given the wide variety of pipe materials out there. Like many other properties, absorption is temperature dependent, and many of the studies you see out there have been validated only under equilibrium conditions. Conditions in the distribution system naturally are likely far different than equilibrium. So, as an illustration, hydrogen cyanide has a KOW of 0.5, an organic pesticide has a particular one has a KOW of 1.3. which is really more likely to persist in the pipes, leading to a slow release of water over time. Well, in this case, you happen to know something about the pipes and the material, the piping material that was used in that part of town, and you found out that the pipes were made of a material to which neither contaminant measurably absorbs, so it's unlikely that either of these will persist. However, it's easy to envision that there is a in another part of town, the pipes were made out of a different material, and only the organic pesticide will absorb to that material. So that concludes part three of this presentation. This brings us to part four, properties and characteristics of pathogens, which will be presented by Ellen Lindquist.